His own life story is itself a dramatic adventure. It starts with escaping from communist Hungary as a boy during the failed revolt against the Russians back in 1956. Later, Ferenc Matej would figure out how to build his own houseboat as a college student in Vancouver, and eventually he'd sail the world with his wife from chilly British Columbia to tropical South Sea Tahiti. Since writing a bestseller do-it-yourself guide to building your own boat in 1970, Ferenc has published a number of books on different topics. They include works about the life lessons he's learned from restoring a centuries-old friary to create his dream home in Tuscany in Italy. And his seafaring voyages have inspired a pair of highly praised mystery novels that weave together history and action in a genre that could be called the romantic anthropological thriller. Ferenc, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. I love this topic.
You can imagine a romantic adventure at sea, but anthropological thriller. How does that work into a sea adventure?
A friend quoted that, another author. I've always been fascinated by old ancient cultures, and we have so many of them. We have right near us, we have the islands just across from the northern tip of Vancouver Island, which is so severe a climate and so severe a landscape that the mountains, the steep mountains, do not allow access even today. There's no road access. So these are isolated
islands. So the isolation,
really. Complete.
And then you did a book in the South Pacific. Let's just set the scene here a little bit. You wrote a book, Sea of Lost Dreams, just in 2011, and that's set in the 1920s in French Polynesia. And then another book called Ghost Sea, written in 2006, set in the Pacific Northwest, in the islands halfway up the BC coast. Tell us, in a nutshell, what each of these novels is about.
Well, it's about the beauty and the enormous colorfulness and the excitement of ancient cultures. There's a lot of history I've got in there about how this culture of 8,000 years survived benignly, benign to the environment, benign to neighbors, and created a culture, not almost a pleasure, but you know how bad a climate is up there. They have 200 inches of rain. So the entire winter, after summer of harvesting and fishing, it was spent with theater. They had this enormous longhouses with no windows, just firelight. And they devised special effects, people being decapitated, people coming out of the grounds, ghosts coming out of the fire. Steven Spielberg would die of jealousy if he saw the theater these guys could devise. It was amazing. And the whole culture was built upon using the masks that you well know in the Northwest. And the totem poles that
were... So this is the drizzly, dank winter halfway up the coast to Alaska.
Exactly.
In these Indian longhouses.
Yeah.
You write so vividly in these books. How on earth do you do your research? How can you know what it was like generations ago in this Indian culture?
Well, Rick, apart from museums and books, which are intensely important, I went to New York, even to the Anthropological Museum there, Natural History, and BC, and Northern BC. I lived in those islands for a few months, and I sailed into every one of them and rode around every one of them and tried to go across the Salal that is so deep and that you get stuck in it. You can even walk through it. You actually get stuck up in the air, and you cannot move until somebody comes and throws your rope. Salal is a really thick bush that grows. It's an evergreen.
Oh, I've broadleaf evergreen. I've tried to hike through those as
it's
a kid
impossible.
In the San Juan Islands.
You end up on top of them, and your leg sinks into them. And
I would spend my whole afternoon. My mom would say, go for a hike, and I'd be gone till almost dark.
There's
a word
the
for
Salal.
That. Salal.
So I spent months, and the villages still existed then. This is 20, 30 years ago. But they still exist. You could find totem poles, fallen totem poles in the woods, and you could find dugout canoes that were used for burial, turned upside down with the skulls and the skeleton inside them. It's like Indiana Jones in these isolated and overgrown villages.
Now, you can take a canoe across a strait way up there in the north end of Vancouver Island, all alone, surrounded by this vivid and lush nature. And if you didn't have any background on the culture and the history and the anthropology there, you could just say, this is beautiful and I can hear seagulls. But if you have a context, then it's that little canoe ride becomes quite rich, I would think, from your novel writing needs point of view.
You know, ironically, I always find that if the less I know initially, the more powerful the impression is when you get there, the more pure it is, the more personal it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've gone to some of these islands that I didn't know they were burial islands, and as soon as I stepped foot on land, I could feel there's something strange here. And I did find skeletons, as I said, and turned over canoes.
You've got to take the initiative to leave the cruise ship route.
Oh, it has nothing to do with
it. Yeah, you've got to break out of tourism.
On your own,
but
completely.
What you're saying is you can find totem poles that are not in museums if you know where to look.
Rotting in the woods. And the experience of finding that is just so rich and so thrilling, you know, compared to an organized tour.
Well, let's just talk about that from a travel point of view, because your book, Ghost Sea, is sort of built around an Indian artifact, a mask. How can a traveler find traditional Native American cultures, on the west coast of Canada in your travels?
The nice thing is there's some villages still exist, living villages. There's one called Half Bay with about 15 people, and it's very small, but it's still they still do carve canoes and they do carve masks, and you're welcome to visit. And it's not terribly commercial at this point. Right. And there's some very good museums up in Alert Bay. There's one beautifully designed. The Museum of Anthropology in Vancouver, you know, that Erickson, fantastic Erickson building, is very, very beautiful.
Also in Victoria, there's a great...
The Royal Museum has a good section on masks.
Wonderful section there.
But the whole thing, you have to understand, the masks were so important. They weren't just for play. They actually represented stories, ancestral stories, which were the history of those people. They didn't have a written history. So the dances and the songs around these masks were the entire history, were the entire ownership of pieces of land or rights to hunting grounds, all that kind of stuff.
So it's
vitally important. It wasn't decoration.
Ference Mate is our navigator today on the good ship Travel with Rick Steves. His novels, in which the sea is the leading character, are called Sea of Lost Dreams, released in 2011, and Ghost Sea, which he wrote in 2006. We have links to Ference and his books in the online notes that accompany this week's show. And you can uncover that treasure each week in the radio section of ricksteves.com. It seems to me there's two kinds of sailors. There's people that want to get somewhere by boat and they like where they're going, and there's other people that really treasure the actual being at sea. So far you've talked about getting to these remote spots, but I know from reading your book that a big part of the richness of being at sea is actually being at sea.
I tell you, nothing like being in a storm or being a few hours at sea, in a sailboat especially, because it's all you. It's all what rope you pull. You're not assisted by anything. It's your wisdom and your knowledge and your stupidity that gets you where you're going.
Well, this is kind of what relates to the quote that you start your book, Ghost Sea, a quote from Joseph Conrad. And tell me, wasn't that the best time? That time when we were young at sea, young and had nothing, on the sea that gives nothing except hard knocks and sometimes a chance to feel your strength, that only. You're just naked in the world there.
You know, after I read that, I thought, I am never going to write another line again. It says it all. You can go through in a few hours so much excitement, so much pleasure of using every part of your body and your brain, because this is even before GPSs. You have to navigate, to think of every headland. Where are you? It's so easy to get lost in these islands especially, and it's dangerous. I mean, you have 15, 16-knot rapids with rocks everywhere, with no visibility into the water, fog and rain everywhere. But you feel so alive having gone through it, you wouldn't exchange it for anything, you know?
Does it bring out something more human when we're so exposed to nature, or does it actually unlock something more primal?
I think that's us. We're built for that. We're built to move and to struggle and to enjoy life and to be afraid and happy and terrified and exalted.
We're creatures living in cubicles looking at screens that have...
Oh, my God.
We have not evolved physically as fast as we've evolved in our lifestyles. So maybe we still have that hunger to be out there in the elements, because when you think of people who have high-pressure lives, their escape is into their sailboat.
Isn't that true?
Yeah.
Isn't that true? But the beauty, Rick, I mean, especially places like Tahiti, Marquesas, where nature is still dominant, and the visions of things that you see at night in total isolation, away from any cities, away from anybody else, the emotions of those kind of things, the islands here at night in this inland sea of ours, you know, up where the Kwakiutl were, and this is described in Ghost Sea, the magic of those still waters, where you can't see whether the reflection is the real thing or the mountain is the real thing. The stars, the odors, the wolves howling that in this wilderness, it just brings out something in you that you think, ha, this is what I was born for, you know?
Watching your face and listening to letting those images just explode in my brain, I was a little bit sad, because I thought a lot of people will never have those experiences. And almost anybody can have them if they just take the initiative to get up there. I think somebody quoted you, said, this could only have been written by a deep water sailor. You know, what does that mean to you?
Well, there's a lot of storm sequences, especially in Sea of Lost Dreams. There's a passage that they take from Mexico down to the Marquesas, which is a 30-day passage even in any circumstance, any sailboat, and they encounter sort of a hurricane. And I was off the Oregon coast stupidly when I was young in a 32-foot sailboat in November when it was snowing. And we left Nia Bay, got some gas at the gas station there, and the guy says in a snowstorm, says, where the hell are you going? He says, we're just going down to San Diego. And says, oh,
it's November,
back.
A snowstorm, a 32-foot
boat. End of November, after my birthday, which is a 12.
What is that like, being out there?
Oh, my God. We motored for the first day, sailed for 2 days, and we encountered a storm, Rick, which we're in about 12 hours. The seas were up to the spreaders, which are probably about 15 to 20 feet, but so steep and so violent that we saw a freighter the day after. rolling in the sea from gunwale to gunwale. So one gunwale would go underwater, then thing would roll. I mean, you can imagine how big the seas were. The violence of the sea, the boat was fine. I mean, it was an ocean-going boat, a Westsail 32 built to go around the world. I mean, it creaked and it leaked a little bit, and the vibration of the rigging and the noise and of the things smashing around down below. And the power of the sea is so great that you feel like the most powerful human being in the world when you actually manage to survive that, you know? And nothing will scare you after that. And there's no fear of death, it's strange enough. I was never afraid to die. I thought, well, you die. But the notion that you have to use your brains all the time to figure out what to do, what sail to take down next, how to handle the next waves. Actually, we had to turn around. The wind was so great off Northern California. We'd been out there for days running out of food, and we didn't have enough charts. It was a rookie captain who never captained a boat before. And the owner of the boat was a gas station and who never sailed in his life before.
Huh.
And me, stupid and young, wanting to feel the power of the sea.
What does that do with the bonding and the camaraderie? Do you feel like you're stuck with a bunch of fools and you could have lost your life? Or do you come out of that thinking, yes, we came together and we beat it?
Well, there were a lot of things that we were missing charts for the coast. And even though the captain was very calm through it all and knew how to handle the sails, that was scary. And I had to get back to work at that stage or I was going to get fired. But you came to the point where you trusted each other very, very greatly. But most of all, it really brought you face to face with yourself, how much you could handle, what is really and what's important to you and how much you can take. And when we turned around, we had no self-steering. So we had to actually steer the boat by hand, a tiller. Mm-hmm. And we turned around, we would take 2 or 3 hour shifts. And I said, I'll take all your shifts. It's so much fun out here at night to sail the boat, surfing down at 10 knots down these huge waves.
You know, so, because you
with
have to
one little sail.
You have to be at the helm.
You had to steer
all night long.
Or the boat would turn over. You know,
so somebody's got to be up doing the shift from 4 till.
Yeah.
From 4 till.
And the other two had
to
sleep or they would die of fatigue.
Right.
You know,
the exhaustion. So you're there all alone, really, and under the stars.
And it's a thrill you wouldn't believe. It's like.
Why? Tell me about that.
Well,
at the helm at 4 o'clock in the morning.
A boat can only sail. It's hull speed, okay? That given boat could only sail at 6 knots,
right.
top speed. We had a little sail up, it's a little storm jib, and we were doing 9 to 10 knots because we were sliding down. No, we were surfing, okay?
Right.
We had the crest, we caught the crest. But you had to sort of you had to put the boat into the crest of the wave and hold it there so that it would not be swamped and it would not go too fast down the wave because then it pitch pulls at the bottom of the crest.
You have to anticipate the waves and so on, and are they lit just by the stars?
You can't see anything, you feel it. You can see.
Is it black or do you have
no? You can see glimpse? No. There's white crest. You know, it's so windy that they get white foam blowing off the wave behind you, so you can't see it coming.
Lit by the moon?
No, there's no moon. This is Oregon. The cloud cover was like 100 feet off the ground.
Yeah, so it could be almost dark.
It is almost dark, but the white things like the foam and the sails you do see. But you mostly feel the movement of the boat and you feel the pressure on the tiller and the keel, and that's what you react to, you know?
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're at sea with Ferenc Matthei. He's written 2 sea novels. One's called Sea of Lost Dreams, set in the 1920s in French Polynesia, and the other is The Ghost Sea, set in the Pacific Northwest, halfway up the coast of British Columbia. And we're talking about how you can be inspired to embrace life by spending time at sea. From what I've learned from reading your books about, you know, the good life in Tuscany and so on, you're really passionate about community and family and friends. And when I think about sailing, it doesn't occur to me that that would be in sync with the beauty of community, but you're enthusiastic about sailing. Talk about community and sailing.
Well, amongst sailors, there's an enormous natural community. Of course, at sea, but you're by yourself, and you're relying only on the crew that you're with. But once you get into the harbor, the bond is almost instant. Of course, you have instant topic, instant experiences. I spent the last few weeks restoring the boat that we have now because it's sort of abandoned itself, the poor thing. And there are people who live on their boats. This is near Victoria. The friendship is so absolutely spontaneous. You're at somebody's dinner, somebody's cockpit for a beer. Somebody comes over to help you. As soon as you need a hand, instantly ask the guy next door, can you give me a hand hoisting a sail? You need something, somebody's there to help. The fraternity is astounding among sailors. It's one of the last true kind of spontaneous and transportable communities.
And transportable is a key word there because I've talked with people who have actually just been vagabonds living out of their boat all over the world, and everywhere they go, they've got community.
And instant friends.
It's a beautiful thing.
And it's an important friendship where you actually rely on somebody for basic needs, you know.
And there are basic needs.
And your life.
You can
actually
your life, Speaking of that, you write vividly about raging currents and whirlpools, and some of my most romantic and exciting memories as a child on my parents' boat was going through the rapids, especially on the west coast of Canada. Let's finish off just with a sort of an adventure with our rapids when the tide is wrong.
Okay, you got given the background. Especially at Stewart Island, there's a set of rapids. It's very long. It's a dog's leg. And it's a 2-mile set of rapids.
And let's set it up first with the tide, because a sailor will for people who haven't been there, you know, you can hit it at the wrong time or the right time,
oh,
right?
You can actually only go through at slack, because an hour after slack tide is when the tide turns. That's the slack tide.
So slack would be just after high tide or just after low tide.
It's okay. About half hour.
If you don't want adventure, you
that's
plan it for that.
That's the only time you go through. It's the only time you're physically capable of going through. I've seen winter photographs of this, and this place sucks down scows. It looks like a hurricane wave after another hurricane wave.
So what we're talking about is a narrow passage between two land masses where the water has to flush through as the tide's moving one way or the other.
Yeah, but don't forget, you're feeding 50-mile inlets. So the amount of water that has to come in and out every 6 hours is phenomenal. You know, you actually get 15, 16-knot currents going through there, and no river runs that fast. But this is not a river, okay? This is, you have to pass, it's fighting the last tide to go in the other direction. It's got whirlpools that suck down scows.
They're flushing scows. Like giant toilets.
And one goes in one direction and 2 feet over, the next one goes another direction. One time we had some family illness and we were sailing back from up north and we came to these rapids or close to them. And my wife, who does navigation, had to fly out. So I was looking at the tide tables. I was with my son, who was only 10 years old at the time. And I said, okay, I've got the slack perfectly, no problem, we're going through. And we started motoring, it was a pissing rain. I mean, it was foggy and horrible. We have no cover at all. We're just sitting out there taking it with our foul weather gear on. And I think, why are there no other boats around? Maybe it's the bad weather. And then we started getting into the pass. And I think, there's an awful lot of movement here in this water. Maybe it has something to do with the wind. And we kept going and said, well, it's too late to turn around now. And it got more and more violent. All of a sudden, I look back and there's a 6-foot wave came from behind us. They pop out of the middle of nothing because, you know, it's not a wind wave. It's a tidal pool wave. And this wave stood right up about 6 feet above us, came right on board, pushed us both down in the cockpit, washed over the boat and vanished. Never came again. And I just said, okay, kid, hang on. We're going through. And we surfed through that thing and came through. And I missed by an hour. It wasn't even, the biggest run is like 3 or 4 hours into it. And so this was like just the beginning. And
so you missed slack tide by an hour and you had that adventure.
And that was enough. And
something your son will never forget.
So the stories come out of real experience in these things, you know.
That's great. Ferenc Maté, author of Sea of Lost Dreams and Ghost Sea, thanks so much for sharing your passion for the sea and what you've learned from it.
Well, thank you for letting me relive it all.
You can share your travel impressions and memories with us in the form of a haiku poem. There's a link to send us your original haiku in the radio section at ricksteves.com. Here are a few great ones that we recently got that we think you might enjoy.
Christine Kuhnhoven from Baltimore sends us a set of haiku impressions about the birds and fish she saw on her trip to Anguilla in the Lesser Antilles. Sugar and water to tempt you, sweet little bird, you capture our hearts. Minnows scatter like confetti as the houndfish glistens on the scene. All strut and bustle, jaunty plumed tail, coxcomb crown, this lot, your kingdom. Frigate bird flying above, elegant, below, soaring stingray sails. And she adds this one about observing Orion in the night sky. I always seek you, broad-shouldered, bright-belted knight of the starry sky.
Next, we consider the great variety of outdoor recreation you'll find in France, from the sea and coastal trails to fun along its canals, plus some of Europe's best skiing in the Alps. It's Travel with Rick Steves.